Welcome to Living Queer, where we explore what it means to be queer in today's world. I'm your host, Erwin De Leon, and today we're joined by arts leader, composer, librettist, dramaturg, and advocate whose two-decade career bridges visionary creative practice, strategic nonprofit leadership, and transformative work in equity and education, Lee Bynum. Lee, welcome. It's so good to be with you again.
Thank you so much, Erwin. I'm so excited to be here. So excited to be on your show. I think this is going to be a lot of fun having a conversation with you this afternoon.
I think it will be. So let's start this way. So for our listeners who are just getting to know you, can you tell us about Maestra and its mission?
Yeah, for sure. So I am currently the executive director of Maestra Music, which is an organization that was founded 6 years ago to provide support, visibility, and community to women and gender non-conforming musicians who work in the commercial theater. And since its founding, it's had a very significant expansion with the Rise Theater Initiative, which seeks to do a similar kind of visibility, bringing to other kinds of underrepresented artists who also work in the theater. So everything from directors and producers to designers of any gender or ethnic identity whatsoever.
So recently, though, is there a particular musician or work of art that partook of Maestra's offerings that stands out to you?
Yeah, absolutely. You asked this just at the right time. We've recently developed a strategic partnership with Liberation, Bess Wohl's new play on Broadway about the sort of genealogies of women's liberation in the US. And it's a perfect play for us to have an affiliation with as a partner, specifically on some of their social justice initiatives. So we're super excited to be a part of that.
And I'd imagine this looks at the intersection of women, right? Like different identities of women.
Oh, very, very much so. And that's really at the heart of what we do. When the organization was founded by a composer named Georgia Stitt, the idea was that there were so many women, and at the time it was very much focused on women, who did not have a space in the commercial theater and who did not necessarily know each other. And if you are familiar with the music staffs in particular on Broadway, before our founding, it was not unusual for there to be absolutely no women and no gender non-conforming people in the pit, and maybe none on the music staff whatsoever. And since our organization was founded, there are almost none anymore. So I think it's been really, really important over the years that we have not just sought to think about where do women fit into this space and how can we facilitate a more equitable, accessible space for women. We've also really recognized a lot of the same challenges exist for non-binary and other gender non-conforming folks in the theater, and have really also tried to expand the work that we do to other forms of underrepresentation, because being able to advocate for those equitable, accessible practices and then develop new models for ways to incorporate people, for ways for people to participate, and perhaps most critically, ways for people to develop greater socialization and professionalization relative to the space is a real way that we are really trying to bridge that gap.
Yeah, I suppose I shouldn't be surprised, but I guess I was just thinking if there was a particular field in which there was more representation for women and non-binary folks and queer people, it would be in theater or in the arts, but it sounds like not the case.
No, you know, the arts can only reflect what is already in society, right? And I think as any of us who survived last fall and the presidential election, I think we got to see that there is still a really pernicious sense of misogyny, and exclusionary practices and set of thoughts that exist around gender and gender identity. And, you know, while in so many ways the theater is very, very progressive, I think especially in terms of How much of an investment has been made in the commercial theater to ensure that there are more performers of color on stage? That same work has to happen behind the scenes, and it still needs to happen with audiences. I will say, having spent, much of the last 25 years working on these issues in classical music, in concert, dance, and in museums, theater is somewhat ahead of some of the other art forms, but this has been a challenge that's existed across a number of sectors, and more attention has to be put into making sure that our art forms and our keepers of culture are reflective of the beautiful diversity that already exists in our society.
No, you make a good point. I mean, we're both in the nonprofit sector, right, as educators and practitioners. And it's true, because if you were a consumer and you look at the arts or in Broadway or, you'd think, wow, there's so much diversity. But I guess behind the scenes, right, like who gets to fund them, who produces these pieces, as well as the organization who leads them, correct?
Oh, absolutely, right. The sort of gatekeeping that we know exists in other spaces exists everywhere, right? We live in a capitalist society, and that already is going to communicate where certain levers of power are, and there are groups of people, including literally half the population, right, that has not had the opportunity to be in these spaces in the past, and it requires a certain amount of redress. I spent a good chunk of the earlier part of my career working on programs related to increasing access for students and faculty of color in academe, and I've brought a lot of those same ways of working to the work that I do in the arts, because I think academe has, some certain Supreme Court cases notwithstanding in the last year or two, has really figured out some ways to make real motion happen in this space and diversify quite a bit. I don't need to tell you, having had some of the professional experiences that you've had, but I think that a lot of those same efforts can be applied to other sectors to ensure that, more of us have the opportunity to be drivers of those sectors as well.
Absolutely. And since you mentioned academia, this is funny because last night I was just talking to a student that approached me. And as you know, I teach at a graduate level program. And she just expressed interest in going for a PhD. And she's a Black graduate of an HBCU. And I just looked at her. I'm like, yes, please. Because as you know full well, Lee, when we go to these conferences or spaces, people who look like us are far and few between, right? We need more PhDs of color, particularly men and Black men and women of color.
Absolutely. And I feel like I was really spoiled in some ways, because my childhood was marked by my parents being in grad school, and my father ultimately, went into the professoriate himself. So there was a way that a lot of that was normalized for me growing up. I knew a lot of Black people in particular who had graduate degrees, a lot of, PhDs in my own family. And by the time I got to college and started to make sense of the fact that, A, this is really uncommon, and B, this is an area where a lot of effort still has to happen, it was a bit of a calling for me to think about, how do I use my personal resources, my personal passion and energy to make more space, first in academe for, underrepresented people, and then much more broadly across a number of sectors. Because I think we will continue to have so many of the social challenges we've had in the United States if we don't start to right size that in a way that is much more focused and intentional than what we're doing right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. I mean, the reality was just talking to my cousin's son, well, I guess my cousin as well, and clearly much younger than me. And when I pointed out to him that the majority of Americans 18 and younger are non-white, are identifying non-white, he, who is a brown person, was a bit surprised. And I go, yeah, the reality is America is fast changing, but the structures and the systems access, right, is far behind.
Absolutely. And we look to 2042, which, for the last 20 years or so has been the date that demographers are suggesting when there will no longer be a racial majority in the United States. There will instead be, pluralities. And, obviously there are forces in our country, including forces in the government, who want to sort of stave that off and slow down that pace of change. And I think those of us who recognize that demographic change is natural and a part of the process that is already in play, there's just more work for us to do to ensure that we don't end up in a situation, like a apartheid South Africa, where there is this very, very small ethnic majority that holds all of the resources and all of the power. That's really not the direction that any of us wants to, well, most of us want to move, I would say. So, we have to be animated around making the right kind of change.
I think at least half of the country will like that, right? But yeah, totally agree. I think that's what I wish people would understand, because you do have some, particularly white men, who would decry the fact that, they're now the oppressed. But we both know who controls the economy, who in
Oh,
controls the government,
absolutely.
who controls the arts,
Absolutely.
correct? Like back to what we started with.
Yeah, I have a colleague who would frequently say, if you are accustomed to special treatment, being treated like everybody else feels like oppression, right? And I think one of the things that I really got to see, and when I was having my own experiences as a chief diversity officer, really recognizing that the work that we were doing wasn't about disadvantaging any one group in particular. It was sort of recognizing where each group was and then thinking about what are the specific supports that each group needs in order to have what is going to resemble a more level playing field. And I think there are, certain factions of society that came out of that moment with this impression that, people were actively working to disadvantage them, as opposed to understanding, no, this is a moment of being decentered. Being decentered is not a punishment. It's just kind of recognizing there are a lot of people in the room, and everyone deserves their moment. And, I can imagine that is a very uncomfortable thing, but it's clearly a part of what needs to happen, because as I think we've seen this really intense pendulum swing back from what is probably only about 30% of the country, it's reflecting a lot of frustration and fear with the recognition that there are other people now who are able to access resources and opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, two things around that. One is the whole concept of decentering. I think it's safe to say that a lot of white people, frankly, don't realize that they are center, right? That the rest
No,
of us,
absolutely.
our lives and our worth is based, right? Is in comparison or to that center.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was in grad school, one of my subfields was whiteness studies. And, by training, I'm an historian, 20th century American. And part of why I was so interested in that is like this idea of certain immigrant groups coming to the United States and which ones, become sort of absorbed into the fabric of whiteness and which ones of them do not was, was just super interesting to me. And I think one of the conditions of how we understand and have constructed whiteness in our society is that it's the default. So people can't see that, if you're watching TV, 90% of the people that you will see on TV will be, in the white middle class, when that is not 90% of the country, right? And I think because as we talked about before, I'm like super into like science fiction and comic books and stuff like that. And you'll read some of the stuff online from, the super fans where they will complain about, like, I guess it was the Star Wars show last year with Manny Jacinto, and a lot of people were really upset because they were like, there's this show and there's so much blackness, there's this Filipino lead, there's queerness here, and nobody wants to see that. And it's like, well, there's some of us who really want to see it. There's some of us who don't feel like this is a special interest. This is just the experience of that many of us live, like that show very reflective of my own life, right? And I think that those are those moments where it's like there wasn't a special interest happening there. It was a reflection on the characters that were true to their life, in the same way that Luke and Leia weren't a special interest. They just happened to be the characters that people were centering. And I think that, as a person who works in the arts, that's the thing that I notice a lot. People really get stuck on that idea that, if you were telling a different story, that you were either, playing to a specific audience and maybe not just kind of recognizing there can be universality in any of our experiences.
Well, thank goodness there are movies now that are black produced and black
Yes.
acted that are doing well in
Yes.
the box office, right? And Asian as
Absolutely.
well.
Absolutely. And that's it's so, it's so critical because, sort of to your cousin's point about not realizing the broadness of the demographics as a person who's lived abroad for a fair chunk of, their adult life, it's hard then to accept here the ways that we create a default that isn't reflective of the rest of the world. I mean, I would imagine most Americans have no sense of the fact that two-thirds of the world's population is Asian. You know what I mean? Like, and when you kind of, I used to do this exercise when I was teaching the core curriculum at Columbia many years ago, where I would sort of go through the populations of each continent, and when people would hear how few people lived in Europe relative to Africa and Asia and the Americas, people would be shocked, right? We'd just be absolutely shocked every time I said, no, there are more people in sub-Saharan Africa than there are in Europe. And that just didn't compute, even with the students of color, because it just hadn't been a part of how we construct education here. And I think it becomes easier to understand why certain things don't move forward when you appreciate that there's a version of the American story that is constructed, and folks are sort of educated into understanding that isn't always reflective or even remotely reflective of the actual situation of our history and current society.
And the thing I think is what's also sad would be for others who have bought into that narrative or that history of what America is like, coming having been raised in the Philippines, growing up there, but also clearly the influence of America, right? And I had to be educated coming here 35 years ago and learning, no, this the real America is not that Lily White Norman Rockwell painting, right? And that actually my people, Filipino Americans, actually have a place in its history even before it became America, right? And that goes for all the different immigrant groups, if you will, where we're all immigrants, including Europeans, right?
Absolutely. And I love that you highlighted that, Filipinos have been a part of the fabric of North America since the 16th century. And I feel like there are a lot of people who talk about, the presence of Filipinos here as being, like these are new immigrants, or this is kind of a new story. And it's like, not quite.
Exactly. Well, it's like Tejanos or people in Texas who know my family has lived in this land for generations, for a century.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, it's yeah, I guess yeah, it can be funny, but it's also sad. And I just hope that, I still would like to believe things will change, but unfortunately, I think I'm old enough to know that it won't change quickly enough, unfortunately.
No, that's certainly the truth. And in the meantime, I think we have to do what we're doing right now. We have to just tell the truth, right? And tell the truth consistently, and try to be, something that can slow down that centrifugal pull back to these, narratives of imperialism, narratives around manifest destiny that are meant to sort of enshrine this idea that America is a certain thing and it's always been that thing and it will always be that thing, as opposed to kind of understanding, no, there's a very specific way we got here and it
Right.
was constructing
Yeah.
racial and other demographic categories to justify the political decisions, right? And you know, that's not a quote woke take. That is just a read on
That's a
history
fact.
that is, you know,
That's
very much supported by the archive.
it. Well, but who bothers me that, right? So when I actually teach my DEI course, or any whenever I talk about DEI, I always make sure that I have this one slide, and the heading is like US history equals DEI history.
Oh, I like that.
Right? Because the
I like
reality
that.
is you can't, DEI didn't just start after affirmative action, right?
Yeah,
It's rooted
absolutely.
in what happened before, right?
Yeah.
From Europeans coming here. Well, we both know that. And as I always say, this goes for the US, for Britain, for France, and other foreign other colonizers. Don't complain when there are a lot of us in your lands, because if you didn't colonize us, or if you didn't import our labor, or worse, enslave us, then we wouldn't be coming here in the first, we wouldn't be here in the first place.
It's funny how frequently that is not brought up in, you know, the conversations, right? And you know, and how much of it's so just disconnected from the realities of, you know, you'll hear certain people. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I, you know, don't just listen to those that are politically align with mine, because as a person who's navigating the world professionally against a lot of different kinds of people, I listen to a lot of, you know, right wing and far right podcasts as well, because I do need to have a good understanding of what people think. And some of it is just like, this is so not historically sound. Like, it doesn't take a tremendous amount of effort to learn the history of the country that is so important to your identity. Then you should actually understand its actual history and not just, you know, the very convenient narratives that are sometimes built.
Yeah, for some reason I suddenly thought of the Bible. You know, you've heard the term text proofing, right? Or people choosing whatever works with their mind, with their form of thinking, or their worldview, right? I mean,
The
if
cherry picking,
or
yep.
I identify as a Christian, but I'm sure the conservatives wouldn't think I am. But really, you know,
Same.
it's anyway, but yeah, it's the same thing with the Bible, right? If you were going to say that the Bible is the true source, well, then we should take the good and the bad.
Yeah, ab absolutely. And you know, my dad would always say, if you have no sense of your own history, there it's impossible for you to move forward, right? And I think that that is a thing that I've sort of brought into my work as an adult, that, you know, having some sense of how we got here is the only way that we're going to be able to have a sense of how to do better going forward. And, you know, there's not a thing in the world that lying to ourselves or our children about this country is going to do that is beneficial. Like, not a single thing.
Yeah, and I would actually argue, what saddens me is that I would actually argue the history and where we're headed, including where we're headed as with all our different identities, only makes for a richer country, I think, and a richer
Yeah,
idea, in my opinion.
I
But
love that.
I
Yes,
really believe
absolutely.
that. I mean, it's sort of, and what's, I really think, you know, people keep on thinking, what's the one thing or one few things that we all agree on regardless? I think just the core values. I think as an immigrant who came here and other immigrants, we all believe in the
Yeah,
same American ideals, but they're
absolutely.
ideals. They haven't been made.
No, they haven't been. And I feel like when I think about the richness of our country, to me it's not the melting pot, because when, you know, if it's a melting pot, it's a weird crucible where we're all sort of losing our own form and history and becoming, you know, something else that is divorced from what we were. I like to think of this as a salad, right? Because you eat a salad and the broccoli is still the broccoli, right? The carrots are still the carrots, but they go great together, but you never lose sense of what makes each thing individually valuable. And like, you know, I lived in Germany for a period, I lived in China for a period, and you know, these are in many ways much more culturally and ethnically homogenous places than we are here. And you know, They are places that are intensely proud of the shared history and the shared culture that they've developed together. And I think we can do that too. We just have to be honest
Yes.
about, what is great about this being a country where our history isn't necessarily that same kind of 8,000 year long view, but in the last couple of hundred years, what have these different groups of distinct people managed to bring together, and how do we move beyond sometimes the horrible ways that, specific groups of us have been treated and continue to make something better because we are acknowledging that we didn't do right by each other initially.
Agreed. And really, there is a lot to be proud of, as well as, yes, be a bit ashamed of for the 250 years, but it's been quite a 250-year reign. But okay, I have to stick with the metaphor. I can't resist. Okay, if we're a salad, what dressing do you think would put us together? Serious and unserious question, right? Like,
No,
what is
it's
that
a.
secret sauce, as they'd always say in this case? What would be the dressing that would bring all of us together?
You know what I would say? I'd probably say just a little bit of oil and vinegar because I feel like you can still taste all of the individual flavors. I personally love blue cheese, but the blue cheese dressing has a way of masking so many other things, right? And I just like the idea that we can be in community with each other by enhancing who we are and being okay that some of us are trans and some of us are immigrants and some of us are people of color who've been here for 400 years and others of us are people of color who just got here or white people who just got here. But pretending or, maybe trying to pour that blue cheese all over everything isn't, I don't know that that's quite the solution for this salad,
No, it wouldn't be healthy.
No, it would
Literally and
also would not be
figuratively.
healthy.
Now, I know that in some ways you continue the same work that you're doing, right, in your podcast, The Score. Right. So I'll shift to that. So the New York Times has singled it out as, quote, one of the podcast opera pros tuned to, right? And so, and whose goal is to bring more diversity, equity, and inclusivity in the arts. So could you tell us how did this endeavor come about? It's been around 4 or 5 years now, or
Yeah, it's like such a happy making story for me, being a bit of a classical music nerd. So for a couple of years, I had this really extraordinary role at Minnesota Opera, where I was the vice president for Impact. And alongside my team, we were able to build the first ever full department in a classical music organization that was entirely focused on equity and access and inclusion. And one of the, there were 10 of us in the department. So we were, the organization put real resource into, making sure that we were considering the experiences focus on inclusion, equity, access, and diversity for the audience, for the staff, and also for the artists. Like we were really considering it across the board. And in our department, when the department started, there were three of us, myself, Rocky Jones, who is a EDI director, and Paige Reynolds, who was the community engagement coordinator at the time. We were like, oh my God, there are three Black people who work at at the same opera company at the same time.
Wow, in
And if
Minnesota.
in Minnesota of all places, and if you're an opera fan, you may know that Minnesota Opera tends to be one of the more progressive opera companies, and it has a very long record of producing not only works in English, but new American work. So it is a company that is, sort of focused on the now in a different way. And my role was created in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, where there was a recognition there's work that we need to do in our community. So my husband and I packed up and left Harlem and, moved to Minnesota. And I so enjoyed Paige and Rocky. And in addition to all of us being Black, we're all queer. And one of the things that Paige said very early on, they were like, it would be amazing if we were a podcast, just because we were having such great conversations. They said, maybe if somebody recorded us and listened to this, this would be super interesting. And I thought, I would listen to this. And so we quickly thought there's a way to build out part of our communication strategy with just the three of us having conversations around why equity and access really matters first, in classical music, but eventually we expanded much more broadly to the arts. So we did that a couple of years at Minnesota Opera. Had a lot of great conversations with everybody from Denise Graves to Monet Exchange, RuPaul's Drag Race winner, and just had a really thoughtful time. And we the show went well enough that we ended up producing it for a year at Lincoln Center, doing a bit of live performance with it. When we were at Lincoln Center, the show was rebranded and it was called Art Class during that period. And we also, during that moment, didn't just focus on opera. We also started looking at movies, hip hop, dance, and a lot of drag, and had opportunities to have conversations with Hilton Knowles and Bob the Drag Queen, Big Frida. Like it was a really exciting time. Did a live show with Nona Hendrix, who's like one of my favorite singers from childhood. And then after our time at Lincoln Center, we became even more interested in an expansive view of thinking about Black queerness vis-a-vis the arts. Paige and I are both gender non-conforming, and Rocky is a queer man, and we really felt like, there are ways that our perspectives are not frequently presented by us. They are co-opted a lot of times, right? There's a whole school of thought on what is defined as cool today is what was just Black and queer yesterday, right? So we really wanted to get in front of that. And now we've been doing the show under our original title, The Score, and we've been looking even more broadly. So sometimes we talk about fashion. Sometimes we do a lot of TV on the show. We do quite a bit of politics and the ways that it sort of shapes everything from academe to pop music. And it's been such a great experience. We're so grateful to our listeners. Thank you to the scorekeepers. And really grateful for the number of really thoughtful artists and other public figures who have given us their time and perspectives. And we've touched on everything from book censorship to, how Black artists are disadvantaged disproportionately by AI, to how, Black artists are trying to use their activism to shift conversation. So I love doing the show. It's a object of passion for me, and it gives me an opportunity to direct my own activism towards things that I care about.
Gosh, I don't know where to go with this. Either talk about Safira Crystal or Zahran Mamdani. Now we've discovered that we're both fans of RuPaul's Drag Race,
Maybe
right?
even super fans based on the
Super fans,
conversation we
right? Like, because yeah, I do
had.
love the franchises. But yeah, well, in a serious note, as someone steeped in the arts and have studied, looked at the history, but particularly when it comes from the Black perspective, what do you think or feel about the ballroom scene now pretty much being played out? I'm using air quotes here. On Drag Race RuPaul. And while I enjoy the international franchises, I wonder, right? Because what do folks who are not even in the US really know about the ballroom scene? They might have their own, right, that develop, particularly where there are Black queer people. But like when I'm thinking, I don't know, of the Philippines or Thailand or whatever. But even in the US, the way, yeah, RuPaul has really, let's just made millions.
It's interesting, right? Because on the one hand, there's a real awareness of, the sort of extraction that happens from communities, especially the Black American community, and the Black American queer community has not been immune from that. And there's such a long history, if you want to go all the way back to like jazz and then rock and roll, to any number of things in fashion and elsewhere. And something starts as being either niche or really focused on the Black community, and then all of a sudden, because of its money-making potential, like it starts to appear in different ways. And You hear that in everything from the lingo. Like my husband and I frequently talk about how many people are just, walking around sounding like black drag queens, hearing, young straight white men talking about, someone shading someone, and you're thinking, I wonder if you even know like the lineage of, this expression. But then there's the other piece of it where, and the Drag Race Philippines is my favorite franchise because there's so many things about it that I find so organically beautiful, where you think about the ways that we just influence each other as practitioners of art, and you don't want to lose that. There are things that inform my own artistic practice that are absolutely not from my, ethnic or ethnic traditions or backgrounds, that are a part of how I think. And I don't think I should have to pay a toll to have been
Good point.
influenced by them, right? And I think it depends on how you wish to use it. And to me, there's something really beautiful when you do that, especially if you understand from where it came and you pay homage to your foremothers, your forefathers, your foreparents with some of this stuff. It becomes a little bit more concerning when it's like, late 80s Madonna on tour, borrowing heavy from Willie Ninja in Vogue, right? And not connecting that to there's an entire population of people, that this comes from. So, just as a person who in my late teens discovered the New York ballroom scene and have been sort of obsessed with it for, more than 20 years, I am really grateful and humbled by the ways that, something that was so niche, 30, 35 years ago has taken the world by storm. And you can see these random, Scandinavian drag queens, whacking on RuPaul to songs they may or may not even understand the lyrics to. That really speaks to the power of the culture.
And I think in a way you touched tangentially somewhat on the whole concept of appropriation, right? Versus respect versus gaining or monetizing, right? There's a difference there because you're talking about respecting,
Yeah, ab absolutely. And I think that's the, that is the difference. And but even to get to the space of respect, there has to be the place of awareness, right? And as educators, I think there's a certain amount of communicating and, again, telling the truth about things to give folks the context. When I was living in Hong Kong for a while, every once in a while I would hear people reflect on, not having much of a sense of the presence of Black people in America, right? Or sort of an understanding of Black Americans as being, like recent immigrants to the United States, and offering people a corrective, while at the same time, the same folks would be like huge fans of Beyonce, or someone would see my hair and would note, would say something about Bob Marley, but not necessarily being able to connect anything about, West Indian culture to why my hair is the way that it is. And those for me are opportunities to share with people, oh, here's some things about my culture that you may not know, right? And look for them to do the same kinds of things, right? Because to me, that's a big part of the point of the exercise, and that's how we avoid people unnecessarily feeling exploited, or that, something, extractive has happened with their own culture.
You will always be an educator, my friend.
I
I
think so. I
think
stopped by that.
that's something we both share. Well, listen, we're both New Yorkers,
Yes, we
so it
are.
would be remiss if we don't talk about our mayor. Sorry
Yay.
about that. Well, I guess that's the answer. Like, how do you feel? Particularly as a Black queer person, right? And really, it's my bigger question, really, behind, all the people I talk with. How does it feel to be a queer, you name it, in our current world, in America now, in light of the recent elections here in New York?
For sure. It's been a really challenging, last 10 and a half months, frankly. And there have been just so many concerns about everything from, the folks in my immediate family and the stability of their citizenship and their right to be here, to other pieces that literally, it was a almost daily conversation with my husband and I until the sort of decision came down yesterday from the Supreme Court not to revisit Obergefell. Just, the concerns about, will we still be legally married in a couple of months? And, Trump 47 started off with an executive order that sort of wrote out of existence non-binary people as if we haven't been here all along, right? And so that moment of seeing Mamdani of, sort of rising was such a relief. I felt like I could exhale because to me, the hallmark of his campaign was one where he was saying, I hear the people. And I'm responding to the people, and I am having a conversation with New York. I am not talking to the rest of the country. I'm not talking to the rest of the world. I want to be your mayor, and I am going to accomplish that not by trying to divert your attention to other groups of people who I'm going to frame as trying to take something from you, but instead to say, if we come together, what can we do? And to me, this is the piece that both of the major political parties have not been engaging with as well as they could. Just what does it mean to in this moment, build a coalition by building actual bridges that come from actually listening to people? And I feel heard. So I'm very, very excited. I'm open. I'm too old to think that any one politician or one political moment can be any kind of panacea, but I do recognize that this is an opportunity to do better than we've been doing, and I'm really excited to see how we can just start addressing even some of the major challenges around things that do not exclude the socioeconomic challenges of being a regular working New Yorker, but also get to some of those things that people are characterizing as identity politics that are like, no, I'm just queer, so I need to make sure that my rights are going to be protected. Like I need to be concerned about that, just like I need to be concerned about my health care and if I can pay for my apartment. Like this is all a part of my life, and I need someone in Gracie Mansion who can hear, I need you to do both. I need you to care about the social stuff and about the economic stuff.
And we will hold him to account for sure.
Absolutely.
We're lucky, right? Or hashtag blessed, if you will, hashtag grateful to live in this state and in this city. But you mentioned, that awful week in January. I think it was the week of January 21 or somewhere there, where Trump issued so many executive orders that particularly targeted the T and the non-binary. It's not even the LGBT, it's really the T, right? And the non-binary folks. I guess, how do you feel about the future? I mean, yes, you were here, we're fine, we're safe. But once we cross literally the state lines, like I have family in North Carolina, when we, you know what I mean? So, well, what do you think? What is in store, yes, for the country, but particularly for us queer folk?
There is very little comfort in this moment, right? And I am deeply unsettled by the fact that our queer siblings across the country don't have the same set of protections we have simply because we live in New York City, right? And that is something that isn't lost on me whatsoever. And I'm worried because I think the reason that the current administration was able to move against the T was because there was so much that was sort of put into the popular imagination about the T being the source of so many issues for a lot of people, just like immigrants have been characterizing as that. I am not Haitian, but that moment of, they're eating the cats, they're eating the dogs. Like when I tell you I had trouble sleeping for weeks after that was because of how easy it was for people to accept that. So to me, what it says is there is a tremendous amount of work that we need to continue to do, because if even part of our group is unsafe at the moment, none of us is safe. Not only because we are united in a shared struggle, but because it's a very slippery slope. And if it can happen to them yesterday, it can happen to any of the rest of us tomorrow. And I think we have really seen that in the last couple of months with the wide range of groups that are losing rights and losing access to things, including the, what, 40 million people whose healthcare is probably going to evaporate sometime in the next 7 weeks. And I think as we start to get into some of these things that cut across demographic realities, and it's not all of a sudden just black and brown people or, populations of queer people that don't exist in large numbers in some parts of the country, people are going to start waking up. But the question is, will it be waking up early enough to change before you have to rebuild the entire thing from the bottom up?
One thing that people say in terms of whether bringing a community together, whether it's the LGBTQ plus community, because we both know it's not as unified, right? But much less for the entire country. Folks always say, end of the day, tell your stories. And to some degree, right, marriage equality proved that, because at least the L, the G, the B, which now we're speaking from my hand on myself, were more palatable to the general population, partly because we've shared our stories. But is it that simple, though? Is it that simple for trans and non-binary, non-cisgender? Is it the same for putting just even poor people, right? Particularly poor people of color. Is it that simple as telling our stories? Because we've told our stories. What's your take on that? Like, what do we need to do?
I think it's a yes and, right? I mean, I think that the storytelling is how we humanize people. And I think a lot of these injustices happen because people aren't humanized. People don't, when I think about, how animated, people on the right are in some instances against, the concept of, trans athletes, and it's like you have no concept, first of all, how small that number is. And part of why this has been a story that's captured so much attention is because it's lacking a human perspective for a lot of people. If you don't know any trans people, if you don't know any immigrants, it becomes very easy for, them to become the boogeyman. And I think a lot of that storytelling hasn't happened in a way that's been as broadly accessible. And I look back to when I was a teenager, and I think, believe it or not, and this is going to sound quaint to the point of silliness, I think so much of what helped the coming out stories of people who are my age, like the geriatric millennials, so to speak, were like the Ellen DeGeneres Show and Will and Grace, Queer as Folk, Noah's Ark, these shows that all of a sudden, where a lot of people watch them, and a lot of not just queer people, like a lot of people like my parents' age were watching these shows and all of a sudden getting a very different understanding of their queer children and their queer family members and neighbors. And I think that really did shift things for people, because all of a sudden it became, oh, they're just people. They're just people who go to the supermarket and come home and cook dinner, and I think that sort of goes against the forces that exist on the other side, who are constantly characterizing us as other. And I think part of why I have continued working in the arts, when God knows I could have made more money and been less stressed working almost anywhere else, is because I think that there is more that we have to be able to do to carry these stories to a greater portion of the country, so that more people can have some sense of, oh, right, we don't want our brothers and sisters and siblings and nieces and nephews and cousins and neighbors and the co-workers that we enjoy at work to have less than we do, simply because we have not been informed about how similar they are to us. And yeah, it's a shame that empathy only seems to work like that,
It
but we know
does.
that it works like that, so we have
It
to sort of,
does.
pull that lever, because that's the lever we have.
This makes me think too of when you now hear of folks who are anti-immigrant or anti-immigration, but not with my gardener or not with that nice man who sells me something, right? But it's to your point, it's this personal connection. And you guess you're right. There's no two ways about this. End of the day, it's that one-to-one connection. But when you've got a country as huge and as polarized, and as you know now, people segregate or live in neighborhoods because of ideology and all that, right? But anyway, so obviously, I guess as my last question, like, what would you tell, to our listeners, particularly young queer folks of color? What are you telling them? Because we're both. If you're a geriatric millennial, what does that make me? I'm Gen X. So am I like calcified or what? But I guess my point is we've lived longer than a lot of our students and younger friends. What would you tell them?
I would say that there is more space to make your own way in the world than it seems as a young person. I remember that really lovely campaign from, 10, 15 years ago, It Gets Better. And I do think that being able to find your own community, develop your own found family, and to be in spaces, to put yourself intentionally and actively in spaces where you will be affirmed and supported is a way that you can sort of pull yourself out of what some of these narratives that you may hear from those who may be well-intentioned, but undereducated about how to communicate to you about what is possible and who you can be, and you just have to do more work than I think our heterosexual or cisgender brothers and sisters out there to put yourself in spaces where you have that affirmation, you have that support, and yes, where you are normalized. Most of the people in my life are queer people of color. That is by choice. But that also means that I don't ever feel like I have to justify or build the case for my own existence, for my marriage, for my way of being, for my way of dress. And I don't have to look to other people to do that either. We start at a different place with each other because we can see each other's shared humanity, which then allows me to show up differently to the heterosexual and cisgender people because I am also not, I'm not even interested in them affirming me because I am already affirmed, right? So that would be my encouragement. And it really did take a long time for me to figure that out. And I am still figuring it out. But, I'm living proof, that you can make your own way and that you can find happiness and success and support.
Amen. I totally agree with you. And on that note, Lee, thank you for joining us and for all that you do in the arts, in education, in the nonprofit sector, in our dear community, and for being unapologetically you. So, to our listeners, you can learn more about Maestra at maestromusic.org and listen to the score on all major podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Erwin De Leon, and this is Living Queer. Be strong and true, and always, always choose light and joy. Thank you.